Well, Anish, I'm very fortunate, I think, to have some of your time, because I know it's very hectic. You've had a lot of people, television crews and so on, that want to talk to you. But here we are in the British Pavilion in front of Void Field. And I wonder if we could just sort of set the agenda, in a sense, for the conversation we're going
sure.
to have.
Sure.
Something that keeps recurring when I think about the pieces I see here and your work in general. And I think it would be useful to just start off by a comment you made about your work, which was that, and I quote, "I don't wish to make sculpture about form. It doesn't really interest me. I wish to make sculpture about belief or about passion or about experience." And I think a much broader approach needs to be adopted in understanding and perhaps perceiving what you do.
I think that's probably true. I think over the last 10 years or so, there's been a tendency to see the work in terms of my background. And I feel that's been a shame. That's really not allowed me to give what I feel might be possible, or to deposit what I feel might be possible. But it's also restricted other people's experience of the work, and I think that's... But that's a battle that's being fought, right, and will continue to be fought, I think.
I mean, some people have said that the notion of the spiritual, almost in relation to the vocabulary that's used to discuss your work, is a welcome addition to the vocabulary of art criticism of recent contemporary work.
If for a long time now, it's been a taboo subject. It's been something that one has not been able to properly deal with. And yet, it is a fundamental of the human condition, and we must somehow deal with it. It's a treacherous path, I think, in between meaningless 60s talk and real things. As human beings, we have consciousness, and therefore that must be dealt with on some level.
And yet it appears to have been denied.
I think artists have dealt with it. I'm not so sure that those that write about art have been able to deal with it. It requires, I think, on some levels, a great deal of intelligence and humility, or whatever that is.
Mm. I think that, having read a lot about your works in preparing for this, I just have an instinctive feeling that something quite fundamental is being missed very often. And perhaps sort of Western literary tradition to explain isn't a very adequate way of discussing what you do, because at the end of the day, the work is here, it has its presence, and the words have their presence, but the two don't seem to me to correspond.
I think we're talking about experience. I don't think it's enough to talk about the spiritual or such things and leave them as ideas. One has to somehow have this whole thing be experiential and not intellectual, or not just intellectual. I would follow, to a certain extent anyway, Boyce's kind of notion about the spiritual, that intuitive intelligence is the highest kind of intelligence. And in the end, intuitive sense is all that one has to go on as an artist, as an artist of my kind anyway.
The feeling I get standing here, and I think it's interesting because there's a lot of people coming through this gallery and looking and responding, and I don't get the sense of an installation in the kind of traditional sense. I get a sense of a site.
Yes. The idea of place has always been very important to the work. A place that's in a sense original. I mean by the word original to do with first. And I think that's to do with centering oneself, allowing a thing to occur specifically rather than in general. A lot of the works are about passage, about a kind of passing through, and that necessitates a place.
Yes. I was just reminded, when you were talking about that, of the early Aboriginal response to the first British settlers, where the notion of ownership didn't have a corresponding concept. It was much more to do with place and to do with site and relevance of a particular area.
I think Barnett Newman also had a very sophisticated and concise way of understanding that art needed to occur in a place. He often used the Hebrew word makom to refer to the present and the beyond in his painting. That's an area I'm engaged in.
Right. In relation to the starting point, I mean, is there a linear thread that you actually trace in these series of works? I mean, with the powder pieces, there's much more of a kind of a correspondence and a relationship between the sequence, but something like Void Field, it seems quite independent of that sequential development.
It is. Works feed off each other. They do grow out of each other. Here, I think the work forms itself both in the room and in the kind of in the emptiness of the room, or in the conjunction between emptiness and fullness. That is not to do with specific physical relationships between the objects, but really I think much more to do with some specific relationship between the body and the objects, which I think is slightly different. That's, I think, quite a change from the early work, actually.
The actual evidence of the artist is missing. There's no sense of the hand, the artist's hand here.
We've just come through a whole period of expressionism, of artists depositing themselves in their works. I think it's... I just don't believe in it. I don't believe that artists have anything to say. I think there must be a way, and there is a way, of arriving at a conjunction of things that have their own reality, quite independent of the artist. Leaving hand out has always been a feature of my work, anyway, in that covering things with pigment was a way of removing hand. Similarly, here, well, as you say, there's very little hand. That, of course, is also something that's part of a post minimalist tradition, I guess.
Can we move into the next room and just have a look at Madonna, perhaps? The large blue piece. Just one thing as we walk through, Anish, is the thing that you've said, I think, on a number of occasions about the work being completed by the person looking at it. I mean, how do you elaborate that statement? Because it implies a pre-knowledge, and if there isn't a pre-knowledge, what actually is the actual element being added to the work?
I think it, again, has to do with not too much hand. Has to do with me not saying too much, not being over-present, somehow allowing... I think one thing that's happened very clearly is that from being about the outside of forms, or with inside implied in the earlier work, it's turned into a condition which is about interiority. And in some way, I seem to have discovered in that emptying out is filling up. and filling up only with what you can bring, you the viewer can bring.
Right. I mean, we're standing in front of Madonna, which is a large, I suppose, the diameter of it is about 9 to 10 feet. And if one looks at it and stands where we are, about 4 feet away, it's very displacing. You know, one loses one's orientation somehow, which I presume is really a product of this deep blue that you've used. You know, one is drawn into it and somehow lost. It's quite disturbing, in a very interesting sort of way.
Well, I always had this ambition to make something totally frightening. This isn't, but it'll happen to me when I can do it.
But colour clearly is a very important feature in your work.
Yes, it is. In a way, this whole show is about a conjunction between, or a conjunction of opposites. That's clearly always been a feature of what I do. Here, the conjunction is between that which is physical and present and that which is not. It's not enough, I think, to speak about void as an entity. In some way, it needs to be physically present. It needs to be experience. It needs to be there as big a reality as it can. So maybe this gets somewhere.
Is there obviously we can't escape the fact that you've made this exhibition here in Venice, which has a very particular sort of light, a very particular sort of history, culture and so on. I mean, how did you respond to that aspect of making this exhibition?
There are works in the show which do tangentially refer to some of that tradition. This work here is called Madonna. And by it, I think I refer to the Madonna of Torcello. Mm. Her blue robe is identifying her as some cosmic mother, some originator. I see void as a potential space in some ways, rather than a non-space. It is certainly existential to some degree, but a condition of beginning rather than of end.
Can we move to the next
one?
We might as well see the works. And the other issue that you've often talked about is that of an interest in alchemy and chemistry in relation to art. And you mentioned Beuys, and you've also mentioned Duchamp. So that, in a sense, it's the magical qualities that materials and forms and spaces can have that perhaps interest you and motivate you more than the sort of formal physicality.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I mean, here with It Is Man, simply a stone with this room cut out of it.
With this sort of carved hole in the stone, when people are drawn into it, somehow one is drawn into oneself once you get there, because it is this endless blackness somehow that one is facing.
I think these are conditions which it's very hard to speak, to put in words. Very hard, if not impossible, to put in words. I must let that be the experience of the work.
Well, now this is a piece called A Wing at the Heart of Things, and it's two large slabs of slate covered in a blue pigment. And one of the questions I think, you know, I'd like to ask you about is the relationship between the individual pieces here.
Between the two pieces here?
Well, and with Void Field and the others. I mean, is there a conscious dialogue that you're interested in establishing?
Very much so, very much so. And this work, A Wing at the Heart of Things, is, in a sense, the opposite of Void Field. If Void Field is about mass and no mass, that is to say, sky or night contained in earth, then the act of painting these two stones blue somehow makes them weightless, somehow reverses that process. It comes to be earth contained in sky. I find that kind of dialogue of opposition very, very important. I think perhaps there's a similar play between Voidfield and Madonna, and between Voidfield and It Is Man. It's been one of the tasks of this show has been to try and get the whole show to work as one work, so that the sequence of events that occurs through it concur and oppose one another.
One thing that, again, another characteristic and something that you've said is to do with the early pieces, the powder pieces, to do with what to do with radiation, and these pieces with kind of holes within them to do with absorption.
Yes.
Well, now we're in another room, Anish. There's a piece here called The Healing of St. Thomas, and unlike any of the other works in the pavilion, this one actually is part of the fabric of the room. You've actually cut a slit in one of the walls, which has a sort of a red powder within it. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the work.
Yes. The work, as you say, called The Healing of St. Thomas. And, of course, it refers to a piece of classical Catholic iconography, which is the incredulity of St. Thomas. I didn't feel I wanted to make a work about disbelief, but it seems that St. Thomas is healed of his doubt by putting his hand in Christ's wound. It seemed sufficient to be to think of the room, the house, the building, as an image of the self, and that the wound occurred there in some real way. It also, the reason why I was drawn to that in the first place, other than Venice, but the reason why I was drawn to that was that it seems to be an image about the femininity of Christ, that in some way, on a very deep level, this process of healing has to do with some kind of transformation into the feminine. In the context of this show, perhaps I feel, although I find it difficult to articulate, that there is a very powerful relationship between wound and void. That is to say, they both perhaps perhaps through some kind of clearly sexual metaphor, refer to points of origin. And that seems, in this context, to be important.
Yes, when I saw it first, I did read it in the way that I know you're interested in sort of female sexual iconography and imagery, and it seemed to have that kind of feeling about it. In moving to the next room, if we can actually get in there with the people. this is a piece called Black Fire, and it has large boulders of either coal or anthracite. And then a vertical concave canoe-like structure.
It's evidently sexual. And is also perhaps in some relationship. Perhaps it is the odd thing out in this show. But I felt it was very important to have it here because it perhaps makes some kind of bridge between wound and void. as we were just saying. Perhaps it articulates in some different way the idea of sight and or place and the idea of physical and non-physical, present and, or material and immaterial in that way.
And you've chosen a material that is symbolic of heating and of providing support.
Yes, yes. That's clearly part of the imagery too, though, I think.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Just finally then, Elise, because I know there's a lot of people waiting for you, the actual context of Venice. I mean, here we are in the British Pavilion and there are several other pavilions, and it's a strange experience, this, in many senses. I mean, how do you feel that the context has worked for you and the works here?
It's been marvellous for me. The show seems to have had a good response, and that's good. But it is strange that I think one of the issues here, of course, is that I'm Indian and representing Britain, and that's something that I've had to deal with. But perhaps the whole notion of the five grand pavilions or the six grand pavilions and the rest on the periphery is something that's out of date. It seems to be a kind of model from the 30s or whatever. We need to change that. I feel that somehow we live in a much more global culture, in perhaps the beginnings of a real post-colonial culture.
Yes.
And it's necessary somewhere to have a wider possibility for artists, because artists do exist other than in
national categories.
Well, other than in the Western context as well, I think.
Yes. I mean, what's interesting in relation to Venice, which tends to close down art into national kind of categories and entities. I mean, here you are an example almost of the contradiction of Venice, really, or the Biennale, in that you do bring together a whole range of kind of cultural influences and interests and consciousness that somehow then become something else. And you've talked about the notion of global culture that isn't local, or parochial, rather.
Perhaps more than local and parochial, that isn't hierarchical. I mean, I think that's the real issue in the end. And that's something to be resisted with a great deal of education above all else.
Mm.
We've got a long way to go there yet, I think.
Right. Yeah. But do you get sort of irritated by this constant kind of identifying of this strand in your work?
That is
of...
it makes me furious. I have a great resistance to trying to look at the work for its Indianness or through my Indianness.
Mm-hmm.
People have walked in here and said, oh, there's a peculiar smell to the show. Did you use some Indian spices? I mean, it's the extent to which this kind of fantasy goes is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think it's to be resisted with anger and energy.
But it comes back to what we were saying earlier about there being an inadequate critical vocabulary to encompass it, but not to somehow highlight it.
Yes, I think that's very true. Yes. Yeah.
Well, now, sitting just by the British Pavilion and with Andrew Graham Dixon, Andrew, you've had an opportunity to look round the Biennale. I mean, what are your first reactions to the whole event this year?
I find it all a bit flat this year. I'm not quite sure why that is. I think partly the reason why I find it flat is that I think the best installed show is by an artist whom I don't particularly admire, Jenny Holzer, which is a tremendously seductive exhibition, and they've obviously spent God knows how many Rockefeller dollars on getting the Italian stonemasons to carve Jenny Holzer's slogans into this beautiful Italian marble, and it does look absolutely great. So it's almost as if the thing that there is to admire most is a piece of showmanship, and to me the whole thing feels a little bit like a fair full of sideshows. That somehow there aren't any artists whom I consider really major here, and the artists who've got a chance to persuade you that they are major somehow haven't quite pulled it off. I mean, Reinhard Mucha's here in the German Pavilion, and it's a very dour, funereal installation. And it's quite interesting. A lot of people are saying, well, Mucha's going to win the prize, the Golden Lion, for the artist of the Biennale. But they're also saying that this is not one of his best things. And I think that sort of says something about the general level of the Biennale this year, that people are saying that someone is going to win basically on reputation rather than on the work that they've produced. And I've been here for 3 days, and what struck me on the first day, I have my reservations about Anish Kapoor's recent work. I feel it's very much the work of somebody who wants to be an international artist, and it's rather self-conscious, these references to Yves Klein. He uses Yves Klein blue, saturated blue pigment on these slabs of slate, and there are also references to Lucio Fontana. He's made a slit in a wall, which is very much what Fontana did to a canvas, and it's as if these art historical references are kind of an attempt to enter the mainstream of modern art. So that's the way I see it anyway. I mean, that's quite possibly unfair, and there's more to the work than that. But having said that I have those reservations, 3 days later, that now seems to me one of the strongest, one of the high points of the exhibition, of the Biennale, is the Kapoor show. And I'm not entirely convinced that's because the Kapoor show is such a great event. I think it's just that it's one of the few installations where you can really see what the artist is trying to do. It's been efficiently installed. It looks good. You can see what's being said. You can see what's being done, and it's being done in a clear and lucid way. And that ends up being the thing that one has to praise the most. And as in the case of the Jenny Holzer, I think that says something about the general, the general level of this year's Biennale.
But do you think that, you know, the Biennale as a kind of entity, I mean, because it is really to do with sort of diplomacy and each country sending their representative, and each pavilion feels a bit like an embassy. I mean, as a model, I mean, here we all are. Most of the sort of the world's art world is actually here looking for something, yet apparently they're not finding it. I mean, is the model something that perhaps really has run out of steam?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it could be that we've just reached one of those sort of fallow periods in art where there's no striking new movement, there's no striking new tendency, we're sort of between things. And that's why, you know, it all feels a little bit flat, and there's nothing where you think, gosh, isn't that, you know, that's radical or that's extraordinary. That may reflect on the international art scene at the moment in general. And it may also reflect on the institutional feel that the Biennale seems to have acquired in recent years. This sort of sense that people are somehow scared of treading on anyone's toes. That there's so much, that a lot of the pavilions look as if they've almost been hung and installed by committee. Which is probably the way they were. I think one thing that's noticeable is that I think pavilions where there's more than one artist, where they haven't just committed themselves to one artist, tend to be weaker. I think if you have an exhibition of this kind with individual pavilions, I think you should really just say to the artist, okay, you know, it's your ball, run with it, and let them do exactly what they want to do. And I don't have the feeling that enough artists have, or maybe a few artists have been given that particular ball, and say Jenny Holzer, for example, has, within the scope of her work, done just about as good a thing as you could imagine that she could do. And the same with Anish Kapoor, but those are exceptions. And throughout, that to me, there's a feeling either of artists who've somehow become overawed by it, or who haven't given it, just for whatever reason, haven't given it their best shot. And maybe that's to do with the way the Biennale works, you know, the way people are told about it, you know, that they're going to be involved a year and a half, and they've got a year and a half to worry about it. You know, maybe it would work better if you just tell the artist 3 weeks before and then just come here and panic and do something, and they might kind of do something exciting. But there is that kind of feeling about that people have perhaps thought a bit too carefully and been a bit too...
Over self-conscious, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's possibly got something to do with it.
What about the sort of events that have been happening in Europe and so on, and between East and West? I mean, have you found any reflection of that? Because the Russian Pavilion is sort of rather strange, I think, with sort of quasi-modern art reflection of Rauschenberg and so on.
The Russian Pavilion I find completely bizarre. I think one of the problems for... perhaps for anybody coming to the Biennale, but it may be just my problem that I don't. Apart from the PA,
occupational hazard doing interviews at the Biennale.
I think one of the problems that a lot of people have with the Biennale is that in the case of, say, the Russian Pavilion, you don't know who the artists are really. You don't know why they've suddenly discovered this passion for Robert Rauschenberg, and you can't really see what most of the work by the Russian artists in that pavilion has to do with Rauschenberg. I mean, there's a series of works called Homage to Malevich. Now, yes. Malevich and Rauschenberg, to me, I don't see the connection. I don't see that there's any link whatsoever.
Perhaps it's the fact that they can do it overtly now.
Yeah, it's kind of like a coming out party for the Russians. Hey, it's okay. American modern art, yeah, we like it. And now finally we can admit that we like it. But the trouble is that the work in the show, which is called, I think the show is actually called A Homage to Rauschenberg, it strikes me as being anything other than a homage to Rauschenberg. So it's kind of peculiar, very peculiar event. But as I say, perhaps because I don't know the artists involved, perhaps I'm misunderstanding the homage to Malevich. Maybe this is in some way... Right. Relevant to Rauschenberg as the Russians perceive him. But there's this kind of sense, I think, throughout the Biennale that you have that there are all these people speaking in different languages to you, and you don't quite know what they're on about. I mean, in some cases, perhaps in the case of France and West Germany and Spain and Great Britain, the language is sufficiently common, and we've seen those artists in Britain, or we've seen them in Europe, and we've seen them at big international exhibitions. But in the case of the Russians, we haven't. In the case of the Japanese, we haven't. So it's almost as if you're stranded. You're trying just to get a toehold in what they're doing. I mean, that becomes particularly apparent in the Aperto, where you just have one work by a young and relatively unestablished artist. And that's all you have to go on, unless you happen to have seen their Düsseldorf gallery show last month or whatever. So I think there's a lot of people kind of desperately trying to understand what's going on. Yeah. So this is, I think, also why when press comment does materialise on this, most of it will be directed at those artists that everybody knows about, because that's our common language. So I think most will be written about, there's a context and people understand what's going on. And of course, I'm sure that's bound to piss off some of the minor, in inverted commas, minor countries who naturally are militated against by the structure of the Biennale, with these great big pavilions devoted to the, in inverted commas, major countries. So it represents a kind of petrified vision of the world order of things, in which Latin America bulks very, very small, for example, and Western Europe bulks very, very large, with the United States over to one side also bulking large. And so it's very hard to kind of... The Biennale is never, as if it keeps on the way it is, it's never going to redefine the world order of art, because it... But by its actual structure, it represents a certain hierarchy. And certain countries always do better than certain other countries. You know, Nigeria, what does Nigeria have? It has half a room at the back of the main Italian pavilion in the basement. Poor guy, you know. Three woodcuts is about all that they can display there. So, you know, were there to be a major Nigerian artist, what would they do at the Biennale?